Hello, it's John Dennis on Wednesday the 1st of April. Today, as the world's leaders jet into London for tomorrow's G20 summit, thousands of demonstrators are holding a welcome party.
I think people are very angry. The anti-globalization movement is famous for carnivals, for party style. And we wanted to restyle the event that we're doing to match the theme of anger. We said four horses of the apocalypse.
Jonathan Friedland tells us to what extent Barack Obama will be dominating the summit and what's at stake for Gordon Brown.
In every way, personal celebrity and the sheer power of the United States means all eyes will be on Barack Obama.
And dissident Republicans warn of further attacks in Northern Ireland.
Oppression breeds resistance, and the people within the six occupied counties are being oppressed and repressed. It doesn't matter what's been said in Stormont, that's the bottom line.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the news headlines and the papers.
US President Barack Obama meets Gordon Brown today ahead of the G20 summit. World leaders are gathering in London amid tight security, where they'll discuss ways to resolve the global financial crisis. Meanwhile, in what's being seen as a challenge to the Obama-Brown model of spending our way out of trouble, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy will hold a press conference to call for a new era of global regulation. The security operations surrounding the summit's already in full swing. Police are warning of unprecedented levels of protest and are telling city workers to dress down or stay at home. Demonstrators have gathered on the border of the Square Mile, from where they'll launch a series of coordinated direct action protests. Anti-capitalist and anarchist groups are targeting the Bank of England, while environmentalists have their sights set on the European Climate Exchange in Bishopsgate. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai is coming under intense Western pressure to scrap a new law which the UN says legalises rape within marriage and severely limits the rights of women. At a conference on Afghanistan in The Hague, Scandinavian foreign ministers publicly challenged Karzai on the issue, and the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is said to have confronted him in a private meeting. At a press conference later, Clinton said women's rights are a central part of the foreign policy of the Obama administration. In sport, Alan Shearer is to take over as Newcastle United manager until the end of the season. The club's former captain, who has no coaching experience, will be charged with the task of avoiding relegation. Newcastle sit third from bottom of the Premier League and have turned to their popular former striker after a desperate run of form under the caretaker manager, Chris Hughton, and amid concerns over the health of Joe Kinnear. And The Guardian's taken four prizes at the British Press Awards, including Website of the Year. It's the second year in a row that Guardian.co.uk has been judged best in category, with judges saying it remains the big daddy of newspaper websites. The Guardian also took awards for Best Digital Journalist and Best Columnist, and Decca Aitkenhead won Interviewer of the Year for her interview with the Chancellor Alistair Darling, in which he said that Britain's facing its worst economic crisis in 60 years. Now for a look at the papers, and most of them feature the Obamas on their front page with various differing headlines relating to the summit. Obama lands on small island near Europe, says The Telegraph. The Guardian goes with Merkel and Sarkozy move to seize summit initiative. Obama flies in to face Franco-German challenge. While the Express is looking for more from the presidential visit, Obama, wife and a team of 500 arrive in Britain to save the world, we hope, is the headline. The FT focuses on the security operation across London, reporting that businesses in the Square Mile are beginning a pre-summit lockdown because of fears of violent protests, while The Sun concentrates on Michelle Obama's arrival outfit with the headline, First Lady is Summit Special. The Sun's front page also features Jade Goody's farewell letter to her sons, which includes the line, "Some person much wiser than me once said that if you never discovered something you would die for, then you haven't lived. Well, you're both proof that I have lived." Elsewhere, The Guardian reports that while other car makers face the crunch by laying off staff and cutting production, Germany's Porsche has quadrupled its profits. It hasn't sold more cars, though. It made the money after controversial dealings on shares in Volkswagen. And The Telegraph picks up on an Ofsted report which shows pupils are shunning outdoor pursuits for the likes of yoga, boxercise and martial arts. The reason? Pupils don't like doing sport in the rain. And see if you can spot a common link between these headlines. The salmon current, how fish could power homes, that's in The Telegraph. After 188 years of ink, Guardian switches to Twitter, reports the paper itself. And from The Independent, my tour of beautiful Guantanamo Bay by Miss Universe. I'll leave it up to you to decide if they're related to today's date. Keep up with breaking news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Tens of thousands of anti-capitalist protesters and environmental activists are converging on London today, ahead of tomorrow's G20 summit. The leaders of the world's wealthiest and most powerful nations are gathering to discuss rebooting the failing global economy and reforming the international financial system. At the Bank of England, protesters intend to unveil the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse: a red horse against war, a green horse against climate change, silver against financial crimes, and black against homelessness. They want to occupy the City of London, one of the great centres of global capitalism, for as long as possible. The Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has said police won't tolerate violence or any threat to people or property. But one protester, Michael Rainsborough, told us the protesters were angry.
I think people are very angry. The anti-globalisation movement is famous for carnivals, for party style. And we wanted to restyle the event that we're doing to match the theme of anger. We said four horses of the apocalypse. So there's a red horse opposing war, and there's a silver horse opposing financial crimes, and there's a green horse opposing climate chaos, and there's a black horse opposing land enclosures. The G20 is enclosing the entire economy on us, and so we wanted to style this with a very English revolution, has been what we have called for.
The Guardian's Paul Lewis says the summit is presenting one of the greatest challenges ever for Britain's police and security services.
Well, it's absolutely huge. One of the biggest policing operations has ever been in the capital for this type of an event. And I guess it will be around three or four different areas. I mean, one of them will be the London Excel Centre, which is where the summit's going to take place tomorrow. But obviously there's already a lot of security around there, and that will be both Secret Service and police, and all the different delegations coming, particularly the Americans, will have their own security in place. But the main area of security will probably be around the City of London, the Square Mile, where most of the protests are going to be taking place, and the two big protests will be taking place. But I expect that police will be on alert across the capital, actually, because there's other marches, offshoots, Stop the War, have a march from the American Embassy to Trafalgar Square. But also, you know, they are expecting individual autonomous groups to mount their own actions, and that could be anywhere in the capital at all.
How confident are the police that they're able to keep order?
I mean, I think they would say they are quite confident they'll do a good job. I mean, I guess that's what they would say. The question is whether there will be attempts at disorder. And, you know, most of the protesters, the vast majority of protesters, will say no, definitely not. They don't want that to happen. And their view is that police have been exaggerating the threat of disorder on the streets, in part to deter people from turning up. And also, they would say, to justify the huge amount of resources that have been spent. But that said, I think there are probably, in fact, I know there are some individuals who would want things to kick off. And there are different gradations of that. I mean, you know, is an occupation of a street or a tube station or a bank disorder, or is that kind of legal direct action? We all know the types of disorder that we all agree with are disorder, like smashed windows and violence and aggression. And whether it reaches that level, I don't know. One thing I would say is that there has been so much media attention and so much hype surrounding this that it's kind of like a hair trigger.
Who are the main groups that will be protesting today?
I'd divide them really into two main groups. One is an organisation called G20 Meltdown, and they're a kind of ragtag band of anarchists, anti-capitalists, squatters, academics, and they're planning to congregate with Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse at the Bank of England at midday. And they will have in amongst them all sorts of different types of groups and organisations with their own agendas. The other group, the separate group, will be Climate Camp. And these guys are kind of slightly more professional. They held a very kind of clean-cut press conference today. They're the people who occupied the King's North power station or a field nearby it, and Heathrow runway as well. So they know what they're doing. They're very professional. And they will swoop on an area of London and set up a kind of carnivalesque camp somewhere in the city. So those are the two main groups. And there are offshoots, as I said. Stop the War Coalition are doing their own march. And they're, you know, as ever with politics, and particularly this kind of politics, it's always fractious. And and people fall out with each other. And that's been happening with the groups of protesters from day one, really. So there could be all sorts of things going on across the capital, but that's how I would divide the two.
Paul Lewis. Well, Gordon Brown has convened tomorrow's summit. He's called on the leaders of the world's biggest economies to rise to the challenges facing the world. On the agenda, economic recovery through fiscal stimulus, tougher regulation of the financial markets, improving global institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, combating protectionism and boosting global trade, and development aid and climate change. There's a lot of excitement at the presence in London of the new American president. I asked columnist Jonathan Friedland whether the summit would turn into the Barack Obama show.
I think all the attention is certainly going to go on him. He's a much bigger media star, well, than anybody, but certainly more than Angela Merkel or even Nicolas Sarkozy, and certainly more than Gordon Brown and some of the other lesser-known figures. He's got media star power, which they don't have. Also, he's a debut star in this show, because he hasn't made a major trip abroad until this one. So there's the thrill of the new about this trip too. And also, he's, let's face it, as somebody put it this week, the boss of the world. It's up to him. The decisions he makes will be the ones that actually influence the rest of the group. Nothing can happen if you don't have the United States on side. And yet, if you do have them on side, and if Obama really pushes for something, it means it has a huge, huge chance of becoming real. So in every way, personal celebrity and the sheer power of the United States means all eyes will be on Barack Obama.
Will he be able to sprinkle some magic dust on this summit and produce a global New Deal out of the hat?
People aren't anymore talking the big language of global New Deal that certainly Gordon Brown was talking about originally. Instead, you've had a huge effort to dampen expectations and to talk instead about the beginning of a process, etc. I think some tangibles will come out of it. I mean, people are saying that there'll be a lot more money, perhaps as much as $500 billion given over to the IMF, International Monetary Fund, partly for use by developing countries. I think there'll be some robust language against protectionism, perhaps even a commitment to restart those ever perennial talks on trade. That will be important, particularly if it comes from Obama, because he has a real protectionist pressure coming particularly from Congress at home. And I think lastly, there will be talk about regulation, and to make sure it's not just talk, perhaps some kind of undertaking about closing and clamping down on tax havens and loopholes. Harder to turn that rhetoric into reality, but I think that will be the commitment. Enough there anyway, so that Brown and Obama and others can say this wasn't just a talkathon, that it did bring concrete results, even if not quite the global New Deal paralleled with Bretton Woods in 1944-5. That Gordon Brown and others were once promising.
The way that the different nations have positioned themselves ahead of this summit is slightly strange, isn't it? Because you've got US and the UK calling for a bigger fiscal stimulus, and then France and Germany warning against it.
This is a huge paradox. I mean, the theme of my column right now is exactly that the world has gone upside down. In the past, it was meant to be the case that Britain and America were the twin peaks of Anglo-American, Anglo-Saxon turbo-capitalism. And it was France and Germany that were the parties or the countries of state intervention. And yet here you have Obama and Brown joining hands to push and prod France and Germany and Europe to do more. And those two saying, no, actually, we want to leave things alone, as if they were the laissez-faire powers. Now, that's a bit of a cartoon and a caricature, because those countries, France and Germany, actually do put a lot in already through welfare spending and unemployment benefits and the like. And they have some justification in claiming, look, we're already doing our fiscal stimulus, we just do it automatically. Nevertheless, the politics of this are odd. Brown and Obama being the advocates of statism, if you like, or state action anyway, and France and Germany dragging their feet and saying not quite so fast.
Jonathan Friedland, and there's full coverage of G20 today at guardian.co.uk/G20. Also on The Guardian's website, Marcel Berlins considers whether prisoners should have the vote. What do you think? Have your say at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. John Henley on great escapes of our time, like the French arsonist who made his getaway by hiding underneath a police van. guardian.co.uk/G2. And Mark Lawson considers how Horn and Corden can survive the critical backlash against their TV comedy show. guardian.co.uk/media. A new watchdog takes over today, overseeing standards in health and social care across England. The new Care Quality Commission replaces three bodies, the Healthcare Commission, the Commission for Social Care Inspection, and the Mental Health Act Commission. Its chief executive is Cynthia Bower. She told our social affairs editor, John Carville, what was new about the watchdog.
First thing that's new that's going to happen is that all NHS providers are going to be registered against the healthcare associated infection requirement, and that's going to signal a big change in how the health service is regulated.
Do you expect that any trust might not get its licence to continue practising?
We don't expect that any trust won't get a licence to continue, a registration, but we do expect a number of trusts to have requirements attached to their registration that expect them to do certain things to improve.
Does that mean that a trust that has conditions imposed might have a period of grace after which you might shut something down if it's not improving?
Indeed. What it will mean is that a trust may well have conditions attached that they would have to complete certain actions within a period of time. After that time, we would be back to check up to ensure those actions had happened. If they hadn't, then we have the option to ratchet them up in terms of a greater degree of requirement from them in order to guarantee that the care is safe.
What new things can you do now that health and social care regulation has merged?
Well, most particularly what we can do is make sure that when we're saying that standards of care are good enough, that that will include aspects of health and social care working together.
Are there any particular reviews that you're going to do on the interface?
We've been consulting on what reviews we might undertake next year, and that could potentially include looking at how people who live in nursing homes have access to NHS-funded care, the healthcare needs, the physical healthcare needs of people with mental health problems and learning disabilities. We're interested in looking at stroke care. So there are a number of special reviews that we're considering doing over the next 12 months that would touch on aspects of both health and social care.
The Healthcare Commission produced some really hard-hitting reports over the last few weeks. What's the tone and style of the Care Quality Commission going to be?
The tone's very much going to be speaking directly to people who use services, ensuring that they get absolutely the information that they need and the assurance that they need around the services that they're going to be using. So it's going to be independent, it's going to be rigorous, it's going to be based on a very high standards of regulatory practice so that we know that when we're making a judgment about the service, we're doing it on the best possible information.
Cynthia Bower talking to John Carville. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, Henry VIII's suits of armour go on display at the Tower of London.
One of the most impressive armours is something that was made for the Field of Cloth of Gold when he was, I think he was 28, and that weighed 94 pounds.
But first, last month's killings of two soldiers and a policeman in Northern Ireland was not murder, it was an act of war. That's what members of a hardline dissident Republican group told our Ireland correspondent, Henry MacDonald. Republican Sinn Féin, that's a political group aligned to the dissident paramilitaries, the Continuity IRA, predicted there would be more such attacks. Josephine Hayden, a former Continuity IRA prisoner who was convicted in connection to an arms find 9 years ago in the Irish Republic, was at the press conference in West Belfast.
And it was inevitable, and it was resistance as far as I'd be concerned, yes, it was resistance.
So it wasn't murder in your view?
No.
What would you define it as then?
I would define it as they were a foreign army who were actually training here in my country to go to Afghanistan to commit. They would be committing murder out there in Afghanistan. They were training here to go to Afghanistan where hundreds and thousands of civilians have been killed as well. I don't think we should be a training ground for any British Army regiments to be practicing here while they go off and do something else somewhere else. But once there's an occupation here, and the country is occupied, people might want to pretend that everything is fine and rosy, and you can brush everything under the carpet. But the more you brush under the carpet, the bigger the pile gets. And if the bottom line is the British Army are here, you have British rule from Stormont, and you have the likes of Martin McGuinness, who ye asked the very same questions of Martin McGuinness 30 years ago like you're asking us now. And I would have likened to say to him in Mali that, like, it's not inevitable that people turn their coats and put on the armour of the state and then repress the very people that they fought beside, because it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, from what you're saying, it seems to me that you're saying there will be more such acts. I mean, if you say they're inevitable, is that right?
Well, I have no inside knowledge that there will be, but to me it's inevitable that it will happen. It is inevitable. You will always find oppression breeds resistance. And the people within the six occupied counties are being oppressed and repressed. It doesn't matter what's been said in Stormont, that's the bottom line.
Now, your colleague, Mr. Walsh, was asked about the traitor epithet that was used by Martin McGuinness. He said that they were guilty, that leadership, of the severest form of treachery. Do you agree with that?
I think that'll be Martin McGuinness's epitaph. It'll be written in his tombstone. Be one of the things he's remembered for, as far as I'm concerned. Again, go back 30 years. Martin McGuinness was out fighting the likes of the occupation. He's not fighting that occupation anymore. He's part and parcel of the occupation. I think he's an awful nerve to say such a thing. Most certainly the Irish people are not traitors. He'd want to look a bit closer to his own heart and his own home.
And what about people who work on, for example, police partnership boards? Are they in the same category?
Well, you see, while you have the situation that you have, the policing boards, again, they're British policing boards. The RUC are British police. And while you have all that storm and thing, implementing British rule, I suppose, while you have all that, you can't have a normal policing board.
Josephine Hayden talking to Henry MacDonald. Now, if you're a regular listener, you may like to follow us on Twitter. I'll be tweeting with updates on what's in the show at twitter.com/guardiandaily. Battle Dress of Henry VIII is the subject of a new exhibition at the Tower of London. The showcase of Henry's armour and weapons is one of many exhibitions on Henry and the Tudors taking place this year, as our arts correspondent Mark Brown explains.
It's to mark the 500th anniversary of his accession to the throne in 1509. So what the Tower of London is doing is they're bringing together this fabulous armour from which has somehow ended up in New York and France and all over the world, and then bringing it back together to what they say will be the biggest exhibition of his armour and weapons for hundreds of years.
And what does it tell us about Henry's physique?
Well, I mean, that is the most striking thing about, you know, standing there looking at the armour. You can see immediately what a big boy he was, you know, in his 20s.
In every sense.
Yeah. Well, he was. He was big, strong, muscular guy. I mean, we know that. We know he's a big guy, and we know he got sort of grossly obese, by the time he died. But when you're looking at the armour, you can see it. So, you know, you've got armour when he was in his early 20s, and they've worked out that he must have had a 34-inch waist. And a 44-inch chest, because armour has got to fit. I mean, it doesn't do you any favours. So you can see exactly how big he was. And then a bit later, I think his waist size goes up to 38. But by the time he was in his later years, it's up to 50-inch waist.
And, I mean, he must have been quite strong to actually move around in this stuff, because it's very heavy.
It is heavy. I mean, it weighed about some of the armour. One of the most impressive armours is something that was made for the Field of Cloth of Gold when he was, I think he was 28, and that weighed 94 pounds.
And that was studied by NASA when they were designing the first spacesuits in the 1960s.
Exactly. Don't ask me details of how technologically advanced it was for the time, but apparently it was really advanced. I mean, what it allowed him to do was just move easily. So you got this 94-pound armour, and here he was, able to move around freely and easily. And it was the armourers at Greenwich did some amazing things, and NASA scientists came to look at it in the 60s when they were designing spacesuits.
And then there are the cod pieces.
Yes. Now, I mean, you have to say, you look at the cod piece and think that's an impressive cod piece. but it was the fashion of the day for them to be, you know, roomy. About that size, which kind of doesn't.
Mark's just gone from one end of the studio to the other now. People thought these had magical qualities after Henry died.
Yeah, women would come a couple of hundred years later. Yeah. What apparently barren women would come, and if you pricked a pin into the lined cloth of Henry's codpiece, that would bring you babies.
Mark Brown, Phil Maynard and Doug Hardy produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.